owes the bulk of Constable Dorful. And a key thing about the golem was that if he was banging a drum, then no one was going to ask him to stop. No one except possibly Lord Rust, who strode up and snatched the drumsticks out of his hands.
"Yes, it are species of your choice's life, in the first of foot,"
shouted Sergeant Detritus, unaware of the events going on behind him.
"You're learning a trade, you're learning self-respect. Also you get spiffy uniform, plus all the boots you can eat. Here, that's my banner."
"What's the meaning of this?"
said Rust, flinging the homemade banner onto the ground.
"Vimes can't do this."
A figure detached itself from the wall where it had been watching the show.
"You know, I rather think I can," said Vimes.
He handed Rust a piece of paper. "It's all here, my lord, with references citing the highest authorities, in case you are in any doubt."
"Citing the high—"
"On the role of a knight, my lord. In fact, the duties of a knight, funnily enough. A lot of it is pretty damn stupid stuff, riding around the place on one of those bloody great horses with curtains round it and so on. But one of them says, in time of need, a knight has to raise and maintain, you'll laugh when I tell you this, a body of armed soldiers. No one could have been more surprised than me, I don't mind telling you. Seems there's nothing for it, but I have to go out and get some chaps together. Of course, most of the watch have joined. Well, you know how it is. Disciplined lads, anxious to do their bit. So that saved me a bit of effort. Except for Nobby Nobbs, because he says if he leaves it till Thursday, he's going to have enough white feathers for a mattress." Rust's expression would have preserved meat for a year.
"This is a nonsense," he said, "and you, Vimes, certainly are no knight. Only a king can make—"
"There's a good few lordships in this city created by the patricians," said Vimes. "Your friend Lord Dowdy, for one.
You were saying—" "Then if you persist in playing games, I will say that before a knight is created, he must spend a night's vigil watching his armour."
"Practically every night of my life," said Vimes. "A man doesn't keep an eye on his armour round here. That man's got no armour in the morning."
"In prayer,"
said Rust, sharply.
"That's me," said Vimes. "Not a night has gone by without me thinking, ye gods, I hope I get through this alive."
"And he must have proved himself on the field of combat against other trained men, Vimes, not vermin and thugs."
Vimes started to undo the strap on his helmet.
"Well, this isn't the best of moments, my lord, but if someone'll hold your coat, I can spare you 5 minutes."
In Vimes's eyes, Rust recognized the fiery gleam of burning boats.
"I know what you're doing, Vimes, and I am not going to rise to it," he said, taking a step back. "In any case, you have had no formal training in arms."
"That's true," said Vimes. "You've got me there right enough. No one ever trained me in arms. I was lucky there."
He leaned closer and lowered his voice so that the watching crowd wouldn't hear.
"You see, I know what training in arms means, Ronald. There hasn't been a real war in ages, so it's all prancing around and wearing padded waistcoats and waving swords with knobs on the end. So no one'll really get hurt, isn't it? But down in the shades, no one's had any training in arms either. Wouldn't know an épée from a sabre. No, what they're good at is a broken bottle in one hand and a length of 4x2 in the other, and when you face 'em, Ronnie, you know you aren't going off for a laugh and a jolly drink afterwards, 'cause they want you dead. They want to kill you see, Ron. And by the time you've swung your nice shiny broadsword, they've carved their name and address on your stomach. And that's where I got my training in arms. Well, fists and knees and teeth and elbows, mostly."
"You, sir, are no gentleman," said Rust.
"I knew there was something about me that I liked.
Can you not even see that you can't enroll dwarfs and trolls in an Ankh-Morpork regiment?
It just says armed soldiers, and dwarfs come with their own axes. A great saving. Besides, if you've ever seen them really fight, then you must have been on the same side."
"Vimes, it's Sir Samuel, my lord."
Rust seemed to think for a moment.
"Very well, then," he said. "Then you and your regiment come under my command."
"Strangely, no," said Vimes swiftly. "Under the command of the king or his duly appointed representative, it says in Scavone's chivalric law and usage, and of course there has been no duly appointed representative ever since some complete bastard cut off the last king's head. Oh, assorted bods appeared to have been ruling the city, but according to the chivalric tradition...
Rust stopped to think again. He had the look of a lawnmower just after the grass has organised a workers' collective. There was a definite suggestion that deep inside he knew this was not really happening. It could not be happening because this sort of thing did not happen. Any contradictory evidence could be safely ignored. However, it might be necessary to find some motions to go through.
"I think you'll find that legally
your position..." he began, and his eyes bulged for a moment as Vimes interrupted him cheerfully.
"Oh, there might be a few problems, I grant you, but if you ask Mr. Slant, he'll say this is a very interesting case, which, as you know, is lawyer talk, for $1,000 a day plus expenses, and it'll take months. So I'll leave you to get on with it, shall I? Got such a lot of things to do, you know. I think the swatches for the new uniforms should be in my office about now. It's so important to look right on the battlefield, isn't it?"
Rust gave Vimes another look and then strode away. Detritus stamped to attention beside Vimes, and his salute clanged smartly off his helmet.
"What we're doing now, sir?"
"We can pack up now, I think. All the lads have joined up?"
"Yes, sir."
"You told them it wasn't compulsory?"
"Yes, sir. I said, it ain't compulsory, you just got to..."
"Sir, Detritus, I wanted volunteers."
"Straight, sir. They volunteered all right. I saw to that."
Vimes sighed as he walked back to his office. But they were probably safe. He was pretty sure he was legally sound, and if he knew anything about Rust, the man would respect the letter of the law. Such men did in a chilly way. Besides, 30 men in the watch simply didn't figure in the great scheme of things. Rust could ignore them. "Suddenly there's a war brewing," Vimes thought, "and they all come back. Civil order is turned upside down, because that's the rules, and people like Rust are at the top of the heap again. You have these aristocrats lazing around for years, and suddenly the old armour's out, and the sword is being taken down from over the fireplace. They think there's going to be a war, and all they can think about is that wars can be won or lost. Someone's behind this. Someone wants to see a war. Someone paid to have Ossie and Snowy killed. Someone wanted the prince dead. I've got to remember that. This isn't a war. This is a crime." And then he realised he was wondering if the attack on Gorriff's shop had been organised by the same people, and whether those same people had set fire to the embassy. And then he realised why he was thinking like this. It was because he wanted there to be conspirators. It was much better to imagine men in some smoky room somewhere, made mad and cynical by privilege and power, plotting over the brandy. You had to cling to this sort of image, because if you didn't, then you might have to face the fact that bad things happened because ordinary people, the kind who brushed the dog and told their children bedtime stories, were capable of then going out and doing horrible things to other ordinary people. It was so much easier to blame it on them. It was bleakly depressing to think that they were us. If it was them, then nothing was anyone's fault. If it was us, what did that make me? After all, I'm one of us. I must be. I've certainly never thought of myself as one of them. No one ever thinks of themselves as one of them. We're always one of us. It's them that do the bad things. Around about this time in his former life, Vimes would be taking the cap off a bottle and wouldn't be too bothered about the bottle's contents so long as they crinkled paint.
"Look."
"Oh, hello. What can I do for... Oh, yes. I asked about books on Clatch. Is that all?"
The librarian shyly held out a small, battered green book. Vimes had been expecting something bigger, but he took it anyway. It paid to look at any book the orangutan gave you. He matched you up to books. Vimes supposed it was a knack, in the same way that an undertaker was very good at judging heights. On the spine, in very faded gold lettering, were the words, "Veni, Vidi, Vici, A Soldier's Life, by Gen A. Tacticus." Nobby and Sergeant Colon edged along the alley.
"I know who he is," Fred hissed. "That's Leonard of Quirm, that is. He went missing 5 years ago." "So he's called Leonard, and he's from Quirm. So what?" said Nobby. "He's a raving genius."
"He's a loony."
"Yeah, well, they say there's a thin line between genius and madness."
"He's fallen off it, then."
The voice behind them said, "Oh, dear, this won't do at all, will it?
I can't deny if you were quite right, the accuracy would be quite unacceptable at any reasonable range. Could you bear to stop a moment, please? They turned. Leonard was already dismantling the tube. If you could just hang on to this bit, Corporal, and Sergeant, if you would be so good as to hold this piece steady. Some sort of fins should do it. I'm sure I had a suitable piece of wood somewhere. Leonard began to pat his pockets. The watchman realized that the man holding them up had paused to redesign his weapon and had given it to them to hold while he looked for a screwdriver. This was a thing that did not often happen. Nobby silently took the rocket from Colon and pushed it into the tube.
"What's this bit here, mister?" he said.
Leonard glanced up briefly in between patting his pockets. "Oh, that's the trigger," he said, "which, as you can see, rubs against the flint, and good." There was a short burst of flame and rather more black smoke.
"Oh, dear," said Leonard.
The watchmen turned, like men dreading what they were about to see. The rocket had shot the length of the alley and through the window of a house.
"Ah, putting this way up on the projectile would be an important safety point to bear in mind for the new design," said Leonard. "Now, where's that notebook?"
"I think we'd better leave," said Colon, moving backwards. "Very fast."
Inside the house, there was an explosion of stars and balls to delight young and old, but not the troll who had just opened the door.
"Ah, really?" said Leonard. "Well, if speed is required, I have this very interesting design for a two-wheeled..."
Acting on an unspoken agreement, the watchmen each put a hand under a shoulder, lifted him off the ground, and ran for it.
"Oh, dear," said Leonard, as he was dragged backwards.
The watchman dived into a side alley, and then jinked and dodged along several others with quiet professionalism. Finally, they leaned Leonard against a wall and peered around the end of the alley.
"All clear," said Nobby. "They went the other way." "Right," said Colon. "Now, what was you doing? I mean, you might be a genius like I heard, Mr. De Quirm, but when it comes to threatening people, you're as clever as an inflatable dartboard."
"I appear to have been a bit of a juggins, don't I?"
Leonard agreed.
"But I do implore you to come with me. I'm afraid I thought that as warriors you would be more inclined to understand force."
"Well, yes, we're warriors," said Sergeant Colon. "But, here, have you got another one of these rockets?" said Nobby, hefting the tube onto his shoulder again.
He had the special gleam in his eye that a small man gets when he's laid his hands on a big, big weapon.
"I may have," said Leonard.
And the gleam in his eye was the mad twinkle of the naturally innocent when they think they're being cunning.
"Why don't we go and see? You see, I was told to fetch you by any means necessary."
"Bribery sounds good," said Nobby.
He put his eye to the tube sights and started making whoosh noises.
"Who told you to fetch us?" said Colon.
"Lord Vetinari."
"The patrician wants us?"
"Yes, he said you have special qualities, and must come at once."
"To the palace? I heard he'd done a runner."
"Oh, no, to the docks."
"Special qualities, eh?" said Colon. Sarge,"
Nobby began.
"Now then, Nobby," said Colon importantly, "it's about time we were given some recognition. You know that. Experienced officers are the backbone of the force. Seems to me," he went on, "seems to me that this is a case of cometh the time, cometh the man." "When's he cometh? I'm talking about us, men with special qualities."
Nobby nodded, but with a certain amount of reluctance. In many ways, he was a much clearer thinker than his superior officer, and he was worrying about special qualities. Being picked for something because of your special qualities was tantamount to being volunteered. Anyway, what was so special about special qualities? Limpets had special qualities.
"Will we go undercover again?" said Colon.
Leonard blinked.
"There, yes, I think I can say there is a strong under-element involved. Yes, indeed."
"Sarge, you just be quiet, Corporal."
Colon pulled Nobby closer.
"Undercover means not getting stabbed and shot at, right?" he whispered. "And what's the most important thing a professional soldier wants not to happen to him?" "Not getting stabbed and shot,"
said Nobby automatically. Right. So, let's be going, Mr. Quirm. The call has come.
Well done, said Leonard. Tell me, Sergeant, are you of a nautical persuasion?
Colan saluted again.
No, sir. Happily married man, sir.
I mean, have you ploughed the ocean waves at all? Colan gave him a cunning look.
Ah, you can't catch me with that one, sir, he said. Everyone knows the horses would sink.
Leonard paused for a moment and retuned his brain to Radio Colon. Have you in the past floated around on the sea in a boat at all?
Me, sir? Not me. It's the sight of the waves going up and down, sir.
Really? Said Leonard.
Well, happily, that will not be a problem.
All right. Start again. Assembling facts. That's what it was about. The world watched. Someone wanted the watch to say that the assassination had been inspired by Clatch. Who? Someone had also beheaded Snowy Slopes, where he stood, and left him deader than 6 buckets of fish bait. A vision of 71-hour Ahmed's big curved sword presented itself for his attention. So, let's assume that Ahmed was Kufura's servant or bodyguard, and he'd found out... No, how could that work? Who'd tell him? Well, maybe he'd found out somehow, and that meant that he might also know who'd paid the man. Vimes sat back. It was still a mystery, but he'd solve it. He knew he would. He'd assemble the facts, analyze them, look at them from every angle with an open mind, and find out exactly how Lord Rust had organized it. Rank bad hat. He didn't have to sit still for something like that, especially from a man who rhymed house with mice. His eye was caught by the ancient book, General Tacticus. Every kid knew about him. Ankh Morpork had ruled a huge empire, and a lot of it had been in Clatch, thanks to him. Except there wasn't any thanks for him, strangely enough. Vimes had never quite known why, but the city seemed to be rather ashamed of the general. One reason, of course, was that he'd ended up fighting Ankh Morpork. The city of Genua had run out of royalty, inbreeding having progressed to the point where the sole remaining example consisted mostly of teeth, and senior courtiers had written to Ankh Morpork asking for help. There'd been a lot of that sort of thing, Vimes had been surprised to learn. The little kingdoms of the Stow Plains were forever scrounging spare royalty off one another. The king had sent Tacticus out of sheer exasperation. It's hard to run a proper empire when you're constantly getting blood-stained letters on the lines of, "Dear Sire, I beg to inform you that we have conquered Betrek, Smail, and Ushistan. Please send Ankh-Morpokian dollars 20,000 back pay." The man never knew when to stop. So he was hastily made a duke and packed off to Genua, whereupon his first action was to consider what was the city's greatest military threat, and then, having identified it, to declare war on Ankh-Morpork. But what else had anyone expected? He'd done his duty. He'd brought back heaps of spoils, lots of captives, and almost uniquely among Ankh-Morpork's military leaders, most of his men. Vimes suspected that this last fact was one reason why history didn't approve. There was a suggestion that this was in some way not playing fair. Veni, vidi, vici. That was what the man was supposed to have said when he'd conquered, where, Pseudopolis, wasn't it? Or Al-Khali? Or Quirm? Maybe Stolat? That was in the old days when you attacked anyone else's city on principle, and went back and did them over again if they looked like getting up. And in those days you didn't care if the world watched. You wanted them to watch, and learn. Veni, vidi, vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. As a comment, it always struck Vimes as a bit too pat. It wasn't the sort of thing that you came up with on the spur of the moment, was it? It sounded as if he'd worked it out. He'd probably spent long evenings in his tent, looking up in the dictionary short words beginning with V, and trying them out. Veni, vermini, vomui. I came, I got ratted, I threw up. Visi, venere, vermusi. I visited, I caught an embarrassing disease, I ran away. It must have been a big relief to come up with 3 short, acceptable words. He probably made them up first, and then went off to sea somewhere and conquer it. He opened the book at random. "It is always useful to face an enemy who is prepared to die for his country," he read. "This means that both you and he have exactly the same aim in mind."
Bingley, 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 beep.
Vimes's hands slammed down on the box.
Yes, what is it? 3:05 p.m. Interview with Corporal Littlebottom, re-missing Sergeant Colon,
said the demon sulkily. I never arranged anything Who told you? Are you telling me that I've got an appointment and I don't know about it?
That's right.
So how do you know about it?
You told me to know about it last night, said the demon.
You can tell me about appointments I don't know about, said Vimes.
They're still appointments, sine qua appointments, said the demon. They exist, as it were, in appointment phase space.
What the hell does that mean?
Look, said the demon patiently, you can have an appointment at any time, right? So therefore any appointment exists in potentia.
Where's that?
Any particular appointment simply collapses the waveform, said the demon. I merely select the most likely one from the projected matrix.
You're just making this up, said Vimes. If you were right, then any second now. Someone knocked at the door. It was a polite, tentative tap. Vimes didn't take his eyes off the smirking demon. Is that you, Corporal Littlebottom? He said.
Yes, sir. Sergeant Colon has sent a pigeon. I thought you ought to see it, sir.
Come in. A small roll of thin paper was placed on his desk. He read, Have volunteered for a mission of vital importance. Nobby is here also. There will be statues of us when this day's work is over. P.S. Someone I can't tell you who says this note will self-destruct in 5 seconds. He is sorry he hasn't got good chemicals to do it better.
The paper began to crinkle around the edges and then vanished in a small puff of acrid smoke. Vimes stared at the little pile of ash that remained.
I suppose it's a mercy they didn't blow up the pigeon, sir, said Cheery.
What the hell are they up to? Well, I can't chase around after them. Thanks, Cheery. The dwarf saluted and departed. Coincidence, said Vimes.
All right, then, said the demon. Bingley, 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 beep. 3:15 p.m. Emergency meeting with Captain Carrot.
It was a cylinder, tapering to a point at both ends. At one end, the taper was quite complex, the cylinder narrowing in a succession of smaller and smaller rings, overlapping one another until they ended in a large fishtail. Oiled leather could be seen gleaming in the gaps between the metal. At the other end, extending from the cylinder for all the world like a horn of a unicorn, was a very long and pointed screw thread. The whole thing was mounted on a crude trolley, which was in turn riding on a pair of iron rails that disappeared into the black water at the far end of the boathouse.
"Looks like a giant fish to me," said Colon, "made of tin."
"With an awn," said Nobby.
"It'll never float," said Colon. "I can see where you've gone wrong there. Everyone knows metal sinks."
"Not entirely true," said Leonard diplomatically. "In any case, this boat is designed to sink."
What?
Propulsion was a major headache, I'm afraid, said Leonard, climbing up a stepladder. I thought of paddles and oars and even some kind of screw, and then I thought, dolphins.
That's the ticket. They move extremely fast with barely an effort. That's out at sea, of course. We only get the shovel-nosed dolphin in our estuary here. The linkage rods are a bit complicated, but I used to be able to get quite a turn of speed. The pedalling can be somewhat tiresome, but with 3 of us we should be able to get up some quite satisfactory accelerations. It's amazing what you can do when you imitate nature. I just wish my flying
Oh, where did you go? It would be difficult to establish what part of satisfactorily accelerating nature the watchmen were trying to imitate, but it was a part which tended to get stuck indoors a lot. They stopped struggling and began to back into the room.
"Ah, Sergeant," said Lord Vetinari, entering in front of them. "And Corporal Nobbs, too. Leonard has explained everything to you?"
"You can't ask us to go in that thing, sir. It'll be suicide," said Colon.
The patrician brought his hands together in front of his lips in the manner of someone praying, and sucked air thoughtfully.
"No, no. I think you are wrong," he said at last, as if reaching a conclusion on some complex metaphysical conundrum. I think that in all probability, going into that thing would be a valiant and possibly rewarding deed. I would venture to suggest that in fact it is not going that would be suicidal,
but I would appreciate your views. Lord Vetinari was not a heavily built man, and these days he walked with the aid of an ebony cane. No one could remember seeing him handle a weapon, and a flash of unaccustomed insight told Sergeant Colan that this was not in fact a comforting thought at all. They said he'd been educated at the Assassin's School, but no one remembered what weapons he'd learned. He'd studied languages, and suddenly, with him in front of you, this didn't seem like the soft option. Sergeant Colan saluted, always a useful thing to do in an emergency such as this, and shouted, "Corporal Nobbs, why aren't you in the metal sinking fish thing?
Sarge, let's see you get up them steps, lad. Hup, hup, hup."
Nobby scrambled up the ladder and disappeared. Colan saluted again. You could usually tell his nervousness by the smartness of his salute. You could have cut bread with this one.
"Ready to go, sir,"
he shouted.
"Well done, Sergeant," said Vetinari. "You're displaying exactly those special qualities I'm looking for."
"Here, Sarge,"
came a metallic voice from the belly of the fish.
"There's all chains and cogwheels in here. What's this do?"
The big auger in front of the thing started to squeak around. Leonard appeared from behind the fish.
"I think we should all get in," he said. "I've lit the candle that'll burn down and sever the string that'll release the weight that'll pull the blocks out."
"Eh, what's this thing called?"
said Colan, as he followed the patrician up the ladder.
"Well, because it is submersed in a marine environment, I've always called it the going under the water safely device," said Leonard behind him. "But usually I just think of it as the boat."
Thinking up good names was, oddly enough, one area where Leonard of Querm's genius tended to give up. He reached behind him and shut the lid. After a moment, any listener in the boathouse would have heard a complicated clonk as bolts slid into place. The candle burned down and severed the string that released the weight that pulled the blocks out, and slowly at first the boat slid down the rails and into the dark water, which after a second or two closed over it with a gloop. No one took any notice of Angua as she trotted up the gangplank. The important thing she knew was to look at home. No one bothered a large dog that looked as though it knew where it was going. People were milling about on the deck in the manner peculiar to non-sailors on board ship, not sure of what they should be doing or where they should refrain from doing it. Some of the more stoic ones had made little camps, defining with bundles and pieces of cloth tiny areas of private property. They reminded Angua of the bi-coloured drainpipes and microscopically delineated household boundaries in Moneytrap Lane, showing yet another way of drawing a line in the sand. This is mine, and that is yours. Trespass on mine, and you'll get yours. There were a couple of guards standing on either side of the door to the cabins. They hadn't been told to stop dogs. Scents led down below. She could smell the other dogs and a strong odour of cloves. At the end of the narrow passage, a door was ajar. She forced it open with her nose and looked around. The dogs were lying on a rug on one side of a large cabin. Other dogs might have barked, but these just turned their beautiful heads towards her, sighted down the length of their noses, and examined her carefully. A narrow bed beyond them was half concealed by silk hangings. 71-hour Ahmed was bending over it, but he turned when she entered. He glanced towards the dogs and gave her a puzzled look. Then, to her amazement, he sat down on the deck in front of her.
"And who do you belong to?"
he said in perfect Morporkian. Angua wagged her tail. There was someone in the bed. She could smell them, but they wouldn't be a problem. Jaw muscles strong enough to sever someone's neck help you to feel relaxed in most situations. Ahmed patted her on the head. Very few people have ever done that to a werewolf without having to get people to cut up their meals for them in future, but Angua had learned self-control. Then he stood up and went to the door. She heard him say something to someone outside, and then he came back into the room and smiled at her.
"I go, I come back."
He opened a small cupboard and took out a jeweled dog collar.
"You shall have a collar. Oh, and here is some food," he added, as a servant brought in some bowls. "Knick-knack, paddywhack, give a dog a bone," is a rhyme I hear your Ankh Morpork children sing. But a paddywhack is a ball of gristle suitable only for animal food, and who knows what part of the animal is its knick-knack.
The plate was put in front of Angua. The other dogs stirred, but Ahmed snapped a word at them, and they settled back again.
The food was dog food. In Ankh-Morpork terms, it meant something that you wouldn't even put in a sausage. And there are very few things that a man with a big enough mincer cannot put in a sausage. The little central human part of her was revolted, but the werewolf drooled at the sight of every glistening tube and wobbly fat bit. It was on a silver plate. She looked up. Ahmed was watching her carefully. Of course, the royal dogs were treated like kings, all those diamond collars. Didn't have to mean he knew.
"Not hungry?" he said. "Your mouth says you are."
Something snapped around her neck as she spun around to bite. Her teeth closed on a mouthful of greasy cloth, but that wasn't as important as the pain.
"His Highness has always liked fine collars on his dogs," said 71-hour Ahmed through the red mist. "Rubies, emeralds, and diamonds, Miss Angua."
His face came down level with hers.
"Set in silver." "A crucial factor, I have always found, is not the size of the forces. It is the positioning and commitment of reserves, the bringing of power to a point."
Vimes tried to concentrate on Tacticus, but there were two distractions. One was that the grinning face of 71-hour Ahmed looked out at him from every line. The other was his watch, which he had propped up against the disorganizer. It was powered by actual clockwork and was much more reliable. And it never needed feeding. It ticked quietly. As far as it was concerned, he could forget his appointments. He liked it. The second hand was just curving towards the top of the minute when he heard someone coming up the stairs.
"Come in, Captain," said Vimes. There was a snigger from the box.
Carrot's face was pinker than normal.
"Something's happened to Angua," said Vimes. The high colour drained from Carrot's face.
"How did you know that?"
Vimes firmly closed the lid on the sniggering demon. "Let's call it intuition, shall we? I'm right, am I?"
"Yes, sir. She went aboard a Clatchian boat, and now it's sailing. She hasn't come off."
"What the hell did she go on board for?"
"We were after Ahmed, and he looked as if he was taking someone with him, sir. Someone ill, sir."
"He's left? But the diplomats are still..." Vimes stopped. There was, if you didn't know Carrot, something wrong with the situation. There were people who, when their girlfriend was spirited away on a foreign ship, would have dived into the Ankh, or at least run briskly along the crust, leapt aboard and dealt out merry hell on a democratic basis. Of course, at a time like this, that would be a dumb thing to do. The sensible approach would be to let people know, but even so... But Carrot really did believe that personal wasn't the same as important. Of course, Vimes believed the same thing. You had to hope that when push came to shove, you'd act the right way, but there was something slightly creepy about someone who didn't just believe it, but lived their life by it. It was as unnerving as meeting a really poor priest. Obviously, it was a consideration that if someone had captured Angua, you knew that the rescue you were going to probably wouldn't be hers. But the gods alone knew what would happen if he left now. The city had gone war mad. Big things were happening. At a time like this, every cell in his body was telling him that the commander of the watch had responsibilities. He drummed his fingers on the desk. In times like this, it was vital to make the right decision. That was what he was paid for. Responsibility. He ought to stay here and do the best he could. But history was full of the bones of good men who'd followed bad orders in the hope that they could soften the blow. Oh yes, there were worse things they could do, but most of them began right where they started following bad orders. His eyes went from Carrot to the disorganizer, and then to the tottering mounds of paperwork on his desk.
Blow that! He was a thief-taker. He'd always be a thief-taker. Why lie? "Damned if I'll let Ahmed get back to Klatch," he said, standing up. "Fast boat, was it?" "Yes, but it looked pretty heavy in the water. Then maybe we can catch it up before it goes very far."
As he hurried forward, he had just for a second the strange sensation that he was two people, and this was because for the merest fraction of a second he was two people. They were both called Samuel Vimes. To history, choices are merely directions. The trousers of time opened up, and Vimes began to hurtle down one leg of them. And somewhere else, the Vimes who made a different choice began to drop into a different future. They both darted back to grab their disorganizers. By the most outrageous of freak chances, quite uniquely, in this split second of decision, they each got the wrong one. And sometimes the avalanche depends on one snowflake. Sometimes a pebble is allowed to find out what might have happened. If only it had bounced the other way.
The wizards of Ankh Morpork had been very firm on the subject of printing. "It's not happening here," they said. "Supposing," they said, "someone printed a book on magic and then broke up the type again and used it for a book on, say, cookery. The metal would remember. Spells aren't just words. They have extra dimensions of existence. We'd be up to here in talking soothlays. Besides, someone might print thousands of the damn things, many of which could well be read by unsuitable people." The Engravers Guild was also against printing. There was something pure, they said, about an engraved page of text. It was there, whole, unsullied. Their members could do very fine work at very reasonable rates. Allowing unskilled people to bash lumps of type together showed a disrespect for words, and no good would come of it. The only attempt ever to set up a printing press in Ankh Morpork had ended in a mysterious fire and the death by suicide of the luckless printer. Everyone knew it was suicide because he'd left a note. The fact that this had been engraved on the head of a pin was considered an irrelevant detail. And the patrician was against printing because if people knew too much, it would only bother them. So people relied on word of mouth, which worked very well because the mouths were so close together. A lot of them were just below the noses of the members of the Beggars Guild, citizens generally regarded as reasonably reliable and well-informed, except in the particular case of Sidney Lopsides, who was paid $2 a day from city funds to wear a sack over his head. It wasn't that he was spectacularly deformed as such, it was merely that anyone who saw him spent the rest of the day with an unnerving feeling that they were upside down. Some of them were highly thought of for their sports coverage. Lord Rust looked thoughtfully at Cumbling Michael, a Grade II mutterer.
"And what happened next?"
Cumbling Michael scratched his wrist. He'd recently got his extra grade because he'd finally managed to catch a disfiguring but harmless skin disease.
"Mr. Carrot was in there about 2 minutes, my lord. Then they all come running out, right, and they..."
"Who were they?" said Rust. He fought off an urge to scratch his own arm.
"There was Carrot and Vimes and a dwarf and a zombie and all of them, my lord. They ran all the way to the docks, my lord, and Vimes saw Captain Jenkins, and he said..."
"Ah, Captain Jenkins, this is your lucky day."
The captain looked up from the rope he was coiling. No one likes being told it's their lucky day. That sort of thing does not bode well. When someone tells you it's your lucky day, something bad is about to happen.
"It is?" he said. "Yes, because you have an unrivaled opportunity to aid the war effort."
"I have?"
"And also to demonstrate your patriotism," Carrot added.
"I do?"
"We need to borrow your boat," said Vimes.
"Bugger off."
"I'm choosing to believe that was a salty nautical expression meaning why certainly," said Vimes. "Captain Carrot?"
"Sir?"
"You and Detritus go and look behind that false partition in the hold," said Vimes.
"Right, sir,"
said Carrot, walking towards the ladder.
"There's no false partition in the hold," snapped Jenkins, "and I know the law, and you can't..."
There was a crash of timber from below.
"If that wasn't a false partition, our Carrot's gone and knocked a hole in the side," said Vimes calmly, watching the captain.
"I know the law too," said Vimes. He drew his sword.
"See this," he said, holding it up. "This is military law, and military law is a sword, not a two-edged sword. There's only one edge, and it's pointing at you. Found anything, Carrot?"
Carrot appeared over the edge of the hold. There was a crossbow in his hand.
"I do declare," said Vimes, "but that looks to me like a burly and strong in the arm Viper Mark III, which kills people but leaves buildings standing."
"There's crates and crates of stuff," said Carrot.
"There's no law," Jenkins began, but he sounded as if the bottom was dropping out of his world.
"You know, I think there probably is some law against selling weapons to the enemy in times of war," said Vimes. "Of course there might not be. Tell you what," he added brightly, "why don't we all go along to Sartor Square? It's full of people around this time, all very keen on the war and cheering our brave lads. Why don't we go along and put it to them? You told me I ought to listen to the voice of the people. Odd thing, ain't it? You meet people one at a time, they seem decent, they got brains that work, and then they get together and you hear the voice of the people and it snarls. That's mob rule. Oh, no, surely not, said Vimes. Call it democratic justice.
One man, one rock, Detritus volunteered.
Jenkins looked like a man afraid the world was about to drop out of his bottom. He glared at Vimes and then at Carrot, and saw no help there.
Of course, you'd have nothing to fear from us, said Vimes, although you might trip on your way down the stairs to the cells.
There's no stairs down to your cells. Stairs can be arranged.
Please, Mr. Jenkins, said Carrot, the good cop.
I wasn't taking the weapons to Clatch, Jenkins said slowly, as if he was reading the words very painfully off some interior script. I had, in fact, bought them to donate them to...
Yes, yes, said Vimes.
Our brave lads, said Jenkins.
Well done, said Carrot.
And you'd be happy to... Vimes prompted. And I'd be happy to...
Lend my boat to the war effort, said Jenkins, sweating.
A true patriot, said Vimes.
Jenkins writhed.
Who told you there was a false panel in the hold? He demanded. It was a guess, right?
Right, said Vimes.
Aha! I knew you were only guessing.
Patriotic and clever, said Vimes. Now, how'd you make this thing go fast?
Lord Rust tapped his fingers on the table.
What did he take the boat for?
Dunno, my lord, said Cumbling Michael, scratching his head.
Damn! Did anyone else see them?
Oh, there weren't many people around, my lord.
That's a small mercy, at least.
Just me and foul old Ron and the Duck Man and Blind Hugh and Ringo Eyebrows and No Way Jose and Sidney Lopsides and that bastard Stooley and Whistling Dick and a few others, my lord.
Rust sank back in his chair and put a pale hand over his face. In Ankh-Morpork, the night had 1,000 eyes, and so did the day, and it also had 500 mouths and 999 ears. Sidney Lopsides again.
"The Clatchians must know, then," he said. "A detachment of Ankh-Morpork soldiery has taken ship for Clatch, an invasion force."
"Oh, you could hardly call it," Lieutenant Hornet began.
"The Clatchians will call it that. Besides, the troll Detritus is with them," said Rust.
Hornet looked glum. Detritus was an invasion force all by himself.
"What ships have we commandeered?" said Rust.
There's more than 20 now, if you include the Indestructible, the Indolence, and the...
Lieutenant Hornet looked at his list again.
And the Prid of Ankh-Morpork, sir.
The Prid?
I'm afraid so, sir.
We should be able to take more than 1,000 men and 200 horses, then.
Why not let Vimes go, said Lord Salachi. Let the Clatchians deal with him, and good riddance.
And give them a victory over Ankh-Morpork forces? That's how they will see it, damn the man. He forces our hand. But still, perhaps it is for the best. We should embark.
Are we entirely ready, sir?
Said Lieutenant Hornet, with the special inflection that means, we are not entirely ready, sir.
We had better be. Glory awaits, gentlemen. In the words of General Tacticus, let us take history by the scrotum. Of course, he was not a very honourable fighter.
White sunlight etched dark shadows in Prince Kadram's palace. He, too, had a map of Clatch, made of tiny coloured tiles set into the floor. He sat looking at it pensively.
"Just one boot," he said.
General Ashal, his chief adviser, nodded, and added,
"Our scryers can't get a very clear picture over that distance, but we do believe one of the men to be Vimes. You recall the name, sire?"
"Ah, the useful Commander Vimes," the prince smiled.
"Indeed, and since then there has been a lot of activity all along the docks. We have to take the view that the expeditionary force is setting out."
"I thought we had at least a week, Ashal."
"It is certainly puzzling. They cannot possibly be prepared, sire. Something must have happened."
Kadram sighed.
"Oh, well, let us follow where fate points the way. Where will they attack?"
"Gebra, sire. I'm sure of it."
"Our most heavily fortified city? Surely not. Only an idiot would do that."
"I have studied Lord Rust in some depth, sire. Remember that he doesn't expect us to fight, so the size of our forces really doesn't worry him."
the general smiled. It was a neat, thin little smile.
And, of course, in attacking us, he is piling infamy upon infamy. The other coastal states will take note.
A change of plan, then, said Kadram. Ankh-Morpork can wait.
A wise move, sire, as always.
Any news of my poor brother?
Alas, no, sire.
Our agents must search harder. The world is watching, Ashal.
Correct, sire.
Sarge?
Yes, Nobby? Tell me again about our special qualities.
Shut up and keep peddling, Nobby.
Right, Sarge.
It was quite dark in the boat. A candle swung from a bracket over Leonard of Querm's bowed head as he sat steering with two levers. Around Nobby, pulleys rattled and little chains clicked. It was like being inside a sewing machine. A damp one, too. Condensation dropped off the ceiling in a steady stream. They had been peddling for 10 minutes. Leonard had spent most of the time talking excitedly. Nobby got the impression he didn't get out much. He talked about everything. There were the tanks of air, for example. Nobby was happy to accept that you could squeeze air up really small, and that was what was in the groaning, creaking, steel-bound casks strapped to the walls. It was what happened to the air afterwards that came as a surprise.
"Bubbles," said Leonard. "Dolphins again, you see. They don't swim through the water, they fly through a cloud of bubbles, which is much easier, of course. I add a little soap, which seems to improve matters."
"He thinks dolphins fly, Sarge," whispered Nobby.
"Just keep peddling."
Sergeant Colon risked a glance behind him. Lord Vetinari was sitting on an upturned box, amidst the clicking chains, with several of Leonard's sketches open on his knees.
"Carry on, Sergeant," said the patrician.
"Right, sir."
The boat was moving faster now they were away from the city. There was even a brackish light filtering through the little glass windows.
"Mr. Leonard," said Nobby.
"Yes?"
"Where are we going?"
"His lordship wishes to go to Leshp."
"Yes, I thought it would be something like that," said Nobby.
"I thought, where don't I want to go? And the answer just popped into my head just like that. Only I don't think we'll get there, the reason being in about another 5 minutes my knees are going to fall off."
"Oh, my word, you won't have to pedal all the way," said Leonard. "What do you think the big auger on the nose is for?"
"That," said Nobby. "I thought that was for drilling into the bottom of enemy ships."
"What?"
Leonard spun around in his seat, a look of horror on his face.
"Sink ships? Sink ships with people on them?"
"Well, yes."
"Corporal Nobbs, I think you are a very misguided young man," said Leonard stiffly. "Use the boat to sink ships? That would be terrible. In any case, no sailor would dream of doing such a dishonourable thing."
"Sorry. The auger, I would have you know, is for attaching us to passing ships in the manner of the remora, the suckerfish which attaches itself to sharks. A few turns is all that is necessary for a firm attachment."
"So you couldn't bore all the way through the hull, then?"
"Only if you were a very careless and extremely thoughtless young man."
The ocean waves may not be ploughable, but the crust of the River Ankh downstream from the city was known to sprout small bushes in the summertime. The Milker moved slowly, leaving a furrow behind it.
"Can't you go faster?" said Vimes.
"Why, certainly," said Jenkins nastily. "Where would you like us to put the extra mast?"
"The ship's just a dot," said Carrot. "Why aren't we gaining on them?"
"It's a bigger ship, so it's got what we technically call more sails," said Jenkins. "And they're fast hulls on those Clatchian boats, and we've got a full hold."
He stopped, but it was too late.
"Captain Carrot," said Vimes.
"Sir?"
"Throw everything overboard," said Vimes.
"Not the crossbows. They cost more than $100 each."
Jenkins stopped. Vimes's expression said very clearly that there were a whole lot of things that could be thrown off the boat, and it would be a good idea not to be among them.
"Go and pull some ropes, Mr. Jenkins," he said.
He watched the captain stamp off. A few moments later, there was a splash. Vimes looked over the side and saw a crate bob for a moment and then sink, and he felt happy. Thief-taker, Rust had called him. The man had meant it as an insult, but it'd do. Theft was the only crime, whether the loot was gold, innocence, land, or life. And for the thief-taker, there was the chase. There were several more splashes. Vimes fancied the ship surged forwards. The chase. Because the chase was simpler than the capture. Once you'd caught someone, it got complicated. But the chase was pure and free. Much better than prodding at clues and peering at notebooks. He flees, I chase. Simple. Veterinari's terrier,
Bingley, 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 beep, said his pocket.
Don't tell me, said Vimes. It's something like 5 p.m. at sea, yes?
No, said the disorganizer. Says here, violent row with Lord Rust, insert name here.
Aren't you supposed to tell me what I'm going to do? Said Vimes, opening the box.
What you should be doing, said the demon, looking very worried. What you should be doing. I don't understand it. Something seems to be wrong.
Angua stopped trying to rub the collar off against a bulkhead. It wasn't working, and the silver pressing against her skin seemed to freeze her and burn her at the same time. Apart from that, and a silver collar on a werewolf was a fairly major that, she'd been treated well. They'd left a plate of food, a wooden plate, and she'd let her wolf side eat it while the human side shut its eyes and held its nose. There was a bowl of water, quite fresh by Ankh-Morpork standards. She could see the bottom of the bowl, at least. It was so hard to think in wolf shape. It was like trying to unlock a door while drunk. It was possible, but you had to concentrate every step of the way. There was a sound. Her ears pricked up. Something tapped once or twice under the hull. She hoped it was a reef. That meant land, possibly. With any luck, she could swim ashore. Something clinked. She'd forgotten about the chain. It was hardly necessary. She felt as weak as a kitten. There was a rhythmic noise, like something chewing at the wood. A tiny metal point splintered through the wall just in front of her nose and rose an inch. And someone spoke. It sounded far off and distorted, and perhaps only a werewolf would have heard it, but words were happening somewhere under her paws.
"Can stop peddling now, Corporal Nobbs." "I am knackered, Sarge. Is there anything to eat? There's some more of that garlic sausage, or there's the cheese or cold beans."
"We're in a tin with no air and we're supposed to eat cheese. I ain't even gonna comment on the beans."
"I'm very sorry, gentlemen. Things were rather rushed and I had to take food which would keep."
"It's just that it's getting a bit crowded, if you get my meaning."
"I will pay out the rope as soon as it's dark and we can surface and take on air."
"Just so long as we get rid of the air we've got, that's all I'm saying."
Angua's brows wrinkled as she tried to make sense of this. The voices were familiar. Even muffled as they were, she recognized the tones. The vague feeling that fought its way through the mists of animal intellect was friends. The tiny little unchangeable center of her thought, "Good grief, next thing I'll be licking hands." She laid her head down near the point again.
"Way to do it, young man. There you go again. Sink ships. I can't imagine how anyone could think of such a thing."
Names. Some of those voices had names. Thinking was getting harder. That was the silver at work. But if she stopped, she might forget how to start again. She stared at the point of metal, the point of metal with sharp edges. The tiny human part of her mind raged at the wolf brain, trying to get it to understand what it needed to do. It was after midnight. The lookout man knelt on the deck in front of 71-hour Ahmed and trembled.
"I know what I saw, Wally," he moaned. "And the others saw it too. Something rose up behind the ship and began chasing us. A monster."
Ahmed looked at the captain, who shrugged.
"Who knows what lies on the floor of the sea, Wally?"
"It's breath," moaned the seaman. "There was a great roar of breath like the stink of 1,000 privies, and then it spoke."
"Really?" said Ahmed. "This is not unusual. What did it say?"
"I did not understand."
The man's face screwed up as he tried to assemble the unfamiliar syllables.
"It sounded like," he swallowed and went on, "ye gods, that was better out than in, Sarge."
Ahmed stared at him.
"And what did that mean to you?" he said.
"I do not know, Wally."
"You have not spent much time in Ankh-Morpork?"
"No, Wally."
"Then return to your post."
The man stumbled out.
"We have lost speed, Wally," said the captain. Perhaps the sea monster is clutching at our keel.
It pleases you to joke, Lord, but who knows what has been disturbed by the rising of the new land?
I shall have to see for myself, said 71-hour Ahmed.
He walked alone to the stern of the ship. Dark waters sucked and splashed, and left a phosphorescent glow edging the wake. He watched for a long time. People bad at watching didn't last long in the desert, where a shadow in the moonlight could be just a shadow, or it could be someone anxious to help you on your way to paradise. The Dregs came across many shadows of the latter persuasion. Dereg wasn't their name for themselves, although they tended to adopt it now out of pride. The word meant enemy. Everyone's. And if anyone else wasn't around, then one another's. If he concentrated, he might believe that there was a darker shape about 100 yards behind the ship, very low in the water. Waves were breaking where waves shouldn't be. It looked as though the ship was being followed by a reef. Well, well. 71-hour Ahmed was not superstitious. He was substitious, which put him in a minority among humans. He didn't believe in the things everyone believed in, but which nevertheless weren't true. He believed instead in the things that were true, in which no one else believed. There are many such substitutions, ranging from, it'll get better if you don't picket it, all the way up to, sometimes things just happen. Currently, he was disinclined to believe in sea monsters, especially ones that spoke in the language of Ankh Morpork, but he did believe that there were a lot of things in the world that he didn't know about. In the far distance, he could see the lights of a ship. It didn't seem to be gaining on them. This was much more worrying. In the darkness, 71-hour Ahmed reached over his shoulder and grasped the handle of his sword. Above him, the mainsail creaked in the wind. Sergeant Colon knew he was facing one of the most dangerous moments in his career. There was nothing for it. He was out of options.
If I add this A and this O, and this I and this D, he said, the sweat pouring down his pink cheeks, then I can use that V to make a void. And that gets me, what you call these blue squares, Len?
Three times ye value of the letter score, said Leonard of Quirm.
Well done, Sergeant, said Lord Veterinary. I do believe that puts you in the lead.
I do believe it does, sir, squeaked Sergeant Colon.
However, I find that you have left me the use of my U, N, and A, B, L, E, the patrician went on, which incidentally lands me on this three times the whole word square, and I rather suspect wins me the game.
Sergeant Colon sagged with relief.
A capital game, Leonard, said Veterinari. What did you say it was called?
I call it the make words with letters that have all been mixed up game, my lord.
Ah, yes, obviously. Well done. And I got 3 points, mumbled Nobby. They was perfectly good words that you wouldn't let me have to.
I'm sure the gentlemen don't want to know those words, said Colon severely.
I'd have got 10 points for that X.
Leonard looked up.
Strange, we seem to have stopped moving.
He reached up and opened the hatch. Damp night air poured in, and there was the sound of voices quite close, echoing loudly as voices do when heard across water.
Heathen clatchy and talk, said Colon. What are they gabbling about?
What nephew of a camel cut the rigging? Said Lord Veterinari, without looking up. Not just the ropes, look at this sail. Here, give me a hand.
I didn't know you spoke Clatchian, my lord.
Not a word, said Lord Veterinari. But you...
I did not, said Veterinari calmly.
Ah, right. Where are we, Leonard?
Well, my star charts are all out of date, of course, but if you would care to wait until the sun rises, and I've invented a device for ascertaining position by reference to the sun, and devised a satisfactorily accurate watch...
Where are we now, Leonard?
In the middle of the Circle Sea, I suspect.
The middle?
Pretty close, I should say. Look, if I can measure the wind speed...
Then Leshp should be in this vicinity?
Oh, yes, I should...
Good. Unhitch us from this apparently stricken ship while we still have the cover of darkness, and in the morning I wish to see this troublesome land. In the meantime, I suggest that everyone gets some sleep. Sergeant Colon did not get a lot of sleep. This was partly because he was woken up several times by sawing and banging coming from the front of the boat, and partly because the water kept dripping on his head, but mainly because the lull in activity was causing him to consider his position.